paradigm of looking first at relationships, then it's what's logical to do, and then what's the law. Basically backwards to the Western world. And so what does this concept have to do with building a global brand? Well, if your company is playing on the global stage instead of the China stage, you got to play by the global rules, certainly. You have to probably participate in about 160 countries, something that most Chinese companies haven't gotten their head around yet. And at the same time, you have to provide that positive brand experience while following global practices. A lot of Chinese companies, initially going global, have tried cloning their business models and this Chinese paradigm to doing business in the US or in Europe. And frankly speaking, the results are pretty mixed. You don't get successful in the highly sophisticated and competitive US marketplace by having a Chinese person who's loosely affiliated with someone else in your company running your business in the US. You get successful by blending your company's unique value proposition with strong international A-list management talent. Chinese ethnicity is not really relevant in that equation. Several years ago, when I'm living in Beijing, I was asked by actually the head of China why there was no China equivalent to Air Force One. And he replied to me, he said, "Hey, come on, Ke, you know the answer to this question. It's the round table concept. And if we did that, we'd need seven." In the PRC, there's a little recognized decision-making paradigm, and it's not top-down Confucian. It's consensus style with Chinese you win and I lose special Chinese characteristics. Think in your mind of an oval table, and not a round one, because if it was round, we would be eating. With an odd number of people sitting around it, I like to use the number seven because it used to be the number of the permanent standing committee of the CCP. Each member at the table represents a specific network and a set of stakeholders, and of course their own personal agenda. The critical point is that sitting at that oval table, the highest ranking person cannot unilaterally say yes for the entire table. But anybody at that table can say no for the entire table. You have to understand that concept if you want to understand how large Chinese companies operate. And if that's how they're operating in China, is that going to affect the way that they look at the rest of the world? Not all Chinese companies are the same, and not all Chinese brands are the same. One of Haier's unique DNAs is really great, world-class after-sale service in China. You know, a call needs to be answered within three rings in Mandarin across the country, and if you're in the city, a service person has to be in your house within 3 hours, even if it's on Sunday. I mean, that's our metric, and that's the best level of service in China, full stop, of anyone. That's one of our unique DNAs. A call came into our nationwide call center in Sichuan, and the customer complained that at the end of his wash cycle, there was mud in the bottom of the drum of the washing machine, and the water wouldn't drain out. So the call center engineer talked to him about it, explained where the drain was, asked him to unclog it, and said, if you still have the same problem and on your next go, give us a call back. So sure enough, a couple days later, he called back, same problem. Haier decided to send a technician out to take a look at this, and it was in a fairly small village in Sichuan. And as he got to the village and went behind the house, the washer's sitting out behind the house, the farmer probably showed him his washing machine, and he had just finished washing a load of freshly harvested potatoes, and the mud was not draining out of the bottom of the washing machine. Now, most companies would react and say, politely or not, they would say, this machine is really not designed for this purpose. Hire's approach to this was, I'll bet you this is not the only guy who's trying to wash potatoes in this. Is there a way for us to adapt this product to this requirement? And with some differences in the drains and maybe changing the way that the water levels are, maybe we can make a machine that actually washes potatoes and clothes. Guess what? We still sell that machine. That example was 10 years ago. And the machine still does a great job on potatoes. And, by the way, last year, Haier introduced a washing machine that washes clothes without detergent and uses electronics. And that helped propel us to become actually the number one provider of laundry equipment across the world, not just in China. I get a lot of questions about, made in China. I think you got a speaker coming up next week. Made in China means melamine, lead paint, and pet food, right? And a lot of Chinese brands get painted by these types of events that are outside of their own control. So what do you do with this? What consumers want, of course, is great quality, but they also want kind of a complete peace of mind. And so with that paradigm in mind, when I introduced Haier brand flat panel TVs in Malaysia in late 2008, everyone in the industry was giving a six-month warranty on the machine and a one-year warranty on the panel. So Haier offered initially a two-year warranty on both, and we grew about 3x times the marketplace. The next year, 2009, of course, all of the competitors decided that they had to follow us. So we took it a step further, and we're offering three-year all-risk warranty, which means if your dog pulls your LCD TV off of the shelf and it breaks, your house is flooded, or the panel actually fails, you're covered for 3 years, no extra charge. What's the important message in this is not the fact that we're doing it and that it's innovative. The important message is that because the quality is there, a one-year warranty and a three-year warranty costs Haier exactly the same. There's no increased cost because the quality really is there, and that's why we can do that. I get asked a lot, what's it like to work for a Chinese entity versus a Western company? And usually I try to couch it in these words. It's the main difference is face-to-face food. Like an overly aggressive mother-in-law, Chinese are obsessed with food. I think this is actually a cultural Chinese thing, not a Haier issue. But anyway, focus on eating together, discussing something, going to banquets with customers, eating lunch together, traveling to India, Thailand, and eating together, of course, Chinese food. This type of getting together socially goes well beyond food and is part of how Chinese entities make decisions. FaceTime and food. It's a real big requirement to be successful in China, hence my recent 10-kilo addition to weight, which didn't actually come from today's lunch. So if I think back about this and going back to the original theme of can there be a Chinese global brand, what does this all have to do with building a Chinese global brand? Do you need to be a Western, transparent, SOX-compliant company to become a global brand? I don't think so. Japan's Let's Meet interminably, meet until we come to a consensus and then execute, really didn't prevent Japanese companies from becoming global brands. Earlier, I mentioned the Qing Li Fa concept. And I think you figured out that I've been in China for a bit. So if you think about a social gathering, maybe a luncheon on a Saturday, There's a business guy, the city party secretary, the head of the provincial Supreme Court, somebody from the police, maybe a lawyer, and they're eating and drinking. No real specific agenda in mind. Maybe we talk about the local provincial Rendahoy, which is coming up in a month, and some exports to the U.S. A few specific favors or questions get asked on after the banquet on the way out to the cars, all of which were non-Chinese brands. And all of these key members now have their spouses along with them. Decisions or agreements that are made offline in these types of settings supersede all other decisions. And oh, by the way, that particular event happened on the 2nd of January 2010, a couple of weeks ago, and I was a guest of one of the participants. The reason I bring it up is that while China's infrastructure and building and highways have changed dramatically since I first went there in 1976, the decision-making processes haven't really changed that much. So the real challenge facing Chinese companies going global and becoming a global brand are understanding how to play in the global business field by the global rules of transparency, the speed of today's communication, and international decision-making. Not about the products or not about the services per se, it's about how to operate. It will mean a commitment and a willingness to invest in intangibles like branding for decades. Not for a year, not for 2 years, for decades. It will mean delegating decision-making across the globe without being face-to-face with Chinese colleagues over a banquet table. And it will mean putting Fa in front of Qing. Is there anything inherent in being Chinese that prevents building a global brand? Of course not. But to become a global positive brand experience will mean focus, patience, and recognizing that the attributes that which have made you successful in China will not necessarily translate to being successful on a global basis. And incidentally, that's a direct quotation from Haier's chairman. This group is looking for an insight as to where the first global Chinese brands will emerge. Well, it will likely come from IT, autos, white goods, or cement, which are actually areas where China is already today the largest market in the world. And it will be a company which has the culture to embrace some of these key global concepts I mentioned today. Haier may be one of the first global brands originating from China, perhaps standing for quality, customer-driven innovation, and great service. Thanks, and considering the audience, with great trepidation, I open this up to questions.
Please introduce yourselves before you ask your question. With that, I'd like to throw open the floor. Who is going to ask the first question? Why don't I put in one while we're all thinking about this, which is, as we've just gone through a global economic shock, China seems to be building its exports now faster than ever. It's building them to some extent without strong brands. Maybe there's more of a cost consciousness in part of consumers around the world. Is brand awareness slightly less important, maybe cost consciousness slightly more important than it was even a year or 2 years ago?
Well, I certainly think that in tough economic times, value is certainly important. And I think maybe one example I would give on that has to do with Japan. Japan is arguably the most brand-centric place in the world. Where else, except for Japanese, would you see them lining up to buy Louis Vuitton stuff in Hong Kong, right? You know, they're crazy about branding. Yet, we had a great year in Japan last year because for the first time in my doing business in Asia, the Japanese were willing to equate value and brand. Not put value over brand, but at least give it a closer parity in the marketplace. And that's a paradigm shift. It's been reported several times in the Nikkei in the last 12 months. that this is a major shift within the Japanese economy and in our particular industry. So I do see that there is some change happening in that marketplace. I do think that, you know, and I think there was a recent article by perhaps somebody in this room in Newsweek talking about generic giants. But as we look at the world and we look at the important factors on making a selection of a brand for acquisition of a refrigerator or whatever, we still see the top issue is brand awareness and brand loyalty and respect for the brand. And we still see that to be much higher than cost or being the lowest cost. Robin.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the question. A lot of marketing experts predicted that China, with its low-cost products, including higher in some categories, would do well by buying foreign brands like, say, Maytag, and then producing the for those. And yet, no one Chinese company has done that. Use that and talk about why you decided not to buy Maytag.
We didn't decide not to buy Maytag. Maytag decided not to sell themselves to a foreign company, period. We weren't interested. I think it'll happen. I still think it'll happen. But one of the other phenomena that's happened as well is that China is not necessarily the lowest cost producer in the world anymore. You know, we as a company have 60-some facilities across the world, and we do parity checks against costs for labor and raw materials and final production and assembly and so forth. China is not necessarily the lowest cost producer.
How quickly are costs going up in China? We keep hearing about rising industrial wages and so forth. Is China losing some of that competitive edge that it seemed to have?
You know, the Chinese have long wanted to see more economic activity off of the East Coast. In other words, to go further inland. It's always been a goal, an objective of the Chinese government. And it's actually, you know, it's one of those things where economics is actually making that happen, because, you know, we have factories now in places like Guilin and in Anhui, Changsha, off the coast, where the labor costs are less than they are in Qingdao.
Brian Bateman from Monroe, thank you very much for your presentation. And with the domestic focus within China and the rebate system encouraging the development of more demand for consumer finance in the rural areas, etc., does that sort of derail the globalization process as everyone has focused more internally for the last 12 months?
I didn't catch your affiliation.
Nomura.
No, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, actually. Prior to the stimulus program, Haier already had been developing a domestic sales channel. We continue to develop it through the stimulus program, and as of today, we have over 6,000 freestanding Haier brand-only shops across the country. And that's driven a lot of economic activity within China, but it hasn't derailed any of our expansion externally. Last year, following up a little bit on what Robin asked, last year we became the cornerstone investor in a recapitalized Australian-New Zealand company called Fisher & Paykel, and we're the largest stakeholder of that company now, which is a high-end it's a high-end brand of appliances and highly respected, number one market share in Oceania area. We're an investor in this company. We got a couple of board seats, but we really look at this more as a collaboration. So in November, Fisher & Paykel started selling the Haier brand in addition to their own brand in New Zealand. And later this year, we will start selling the Fisher & Paykel brand in Haier's channel of distribution across China. So we haven't slowed down our efforts at both domestically or globally. And I didn't want to be too cheeky and say we can walk and chew gum at the same time, but we are a company that has that capability.
Over in the corner here, please.
Dr. Carmichael, my name is Dennis Law, with the Lee Fox Strategy International and former professor of Chinese here at Hong Kong. I really wish that the Haier company will be the first global bank of China. My question is, you are a foreigner working in such a company. Do you find difficulty in communicating, helping them to realize the real importance of branding and any other challenges? Thank you.
Well, thank you for that comment, and I hope that we are the first global brand as well. As I said, one of my biggest challenges is keeping my weight down. It's not just because I do like to eat anyway, but the fact is that a lot of activity happens over round tables talking to somebody. But I don't think it's been a matter of, you know, let me give you one specific example why I don't think that Haier doesn't understand the need to invest every year in branding. 2009 was a tough year for a lot of people, a lot of cutbacks and a lot of things happening here and there. And one of the first things that usually gets cut back are things like brand advertising or work with PR agencies, things like that. In 2009, the budget that I had for branding within Asia Pacific was double what it was in 2008. That's what helped drive us ahead. That's what helped drive us as of end of December to be the number one. Every company in the world lost market share on a worldwide basis last year, except for Haier. Because we understand the importance of investing even in the tough times. I mean, I was opening a new factory in Thailand, a new air conditioning factory, with new investment in Q1 of last year. Fisher & Paykel was in Q2 of last year. You know, we have continued to move through tough economic times and position ourselves in a great way to be able to be in even a stronger position at the end of the economic downturn.
Up in the front here, and then over the side.
Thank you. Robin Fox. At the beginning of your interesting speech, you mentioned the guidelines and the policies associated with and by the buyers. And you then mentioned that in China, Haier was associated with service. Now, if you took your brand overseas, what particular qualities would you like to see associated with it in the American market? And then you know the Japanese group there. These two learn for outstanding reliability, but given to lose that now, how would you carry the Haier brand overseas?
I think, as I said earlier, what I consider, again, incidentally, all the characteristics I associated with those brands are, of course, my personal comments. And I actually come from the town where McDonald's is headquartered, so I have nothing to say on that one. But what I'd like to see, I believe that, as I said, the global brands should have, it should be the same experience globally. That's the essence of a global brand. Otherwise, you're a local brand. So I believe that Haier globally needs to be have the best after-sale service, period. It has to do that. And we're working that way in the countries that I manage in Asia-Pacific. And the way to do that is to run it yourself, not subcontract it, which is the way we do it in China, incidentally. And I believe that that will help take us one step further. I would argue that if we're going to be a global brand, we're going to have to offer that same sort of customer-driven washing potato innovation in across the globe with world-class after-sales service and great quality. That's what we're going to have to be if we're going to be a global brand.
Philip, Mark here with Imaginet Consultants. Your three brand promises of three rings, 3 hours, and 3 years are very impressive. As you're taking higher now into the global markets, into Europe, into the US, how are you able to deliver on those three brand promises? Particularly, if you're going into Europe, 3 days would have been an impressive response to fix your washing machine. What are the challenges that you're finding in sort of delivering on your three promises of three?
Well, first off, my three rings of three are with here within Asia Pacific, and we are able to deliver on those within Asia Pacific. As you recognize. By the question, there's people involved in this as well, whether it's call center people or physical technicians going out and with a wrench or and physically doing something. So it takes a little bit longer to develop that infrastructure to that level in Europe or the U.S. I personally do not manage that part of the globe at this point, so I can't give you any specifics, but I know that we're using the same metrics worldwide, and on a daily basis we get a scorecard on how we're doing to those global metrics, and that's how international companies operate. Aspirationally, we're going for the same goal.
Up here in the front, please.
Paul Clarenon. Do you think there is a limit as to the global market share you can hope for, and beyond which it's not worth it to, or growth is too difficult to get? And in that case, are you considering diversifying out of your original sector? And I don't mean going from potatoes into carrots, but into completely different leveraging on the brand into different areas.
That's a great question. I think if we have to diversify out of potatoes, I would prefer to go into fromage. But this particular market or industry is quite fragmented. I'll throw out a couple of numbers for you. We are the world's number one appliance company, and we have 5.1% of the worldwide share, based on Euromonitor's December report. I think the next guy in line is Whirlpool, who has 4.7% share, and below that comes Panasonic, Electrolux, and so on and so forth. Highly fragmented. In China, we're running overall around 30% and about 40% on high-end product. So there's a lot of delta between 5% and 30 or 40%, so I think we've got a fair piece to go before we think about diversification.
Mr. Mers, on the balcony there right behind you, please.
Martin Mers, North America. You shared with us some very interesting anecdotes about dinner parties, but the China story wouldn't be complete without referring to the other party. How much is the CCP, the Communist Party, involved in the company, directly? Is it a party committee? Is it a party secretary who runs the party, the dinner parties? Or is it from the Qingdao city government or even the Shandong provincial government? What is their involvement with the company?
Yes, yes, no, yes. There is a party committee within the company, and its office is right around the hall from mine, as a matter of fact. Yes, there is a person who is a senior party member within the company who happens to be our CEO, who is a member of the Ren Dahui and a delegate to the National People's Congress. Several other executives are members of the local National People's Congress that feeds into the provincial National People's Congress. It used to be, when I first went to China, I want to say that I'll be a little bit off on these numbers, but I want to say that it used to be, you know, party membership was well under a fraction of a percent back when I first went to China in the 70s. And today, the percentage of the total has gone up. And there are a number of, you know, the numbers of people that are members of the party has risen in actual terms and actually as a percentage of the working population. That being said, I mean, there are party members who work with me, for me, and that I work for, but that doesn't have any impact on our business. It doesn't, I'm not getting directives that say you have to do this or you have to do that. The directives that I get more have to do with quality control. Are you meeting your growth numbers? And what did you do for me last week? Rather than anything that comes from specific influence or not from any external organization. I mean, we're basically in the business of building, selling home appliances, full stop. And we don't get anything else that. And I've seen it from the inside. And we don't have any influence that happens other than that.
Just to put in another question here, we know your main responsibility is for Asia-Pacific outside China, but nobody can look at what seems like the boom in China and also the boom in Chinese exports in the last couple months without wondering what's going on. Do you see China as having really emerged from the global economic slowdown, or is it still having a lingering effect, maybe in other industries that you're aware of in the Qingdao area, as a result of continued concerns on the export side?
I thought we took a pass on the economic crisis. We did not have a recession in China. We actually had posted year-on-year actual gain in 2009. I don't think a lot of economies in the world did. We had slower growth, for sure, but we had actual real growth in 2009. I think it goes back to what I was saying before. When I was over at Bloomberg this morning, somebody was talking about the same question. I think one of the statistics that got missed was that there are, I mean, you take Qingdao as an example. Qingdao is a third-tier Chinese city with 8 million people. There are somewhere in north of 45 cities in China that are over 5 million people. And it's a booming, vibrant economy. The countryside continues to be a conservative place, but also where people save their money and have money to spend now, and increasingly can spend it more freely. So is the export boom over? I don't know, but the consumer and the domestic opportunities within China continue to be tremendous.
Phil, just quickly, could you explain how HIRA's status is a little bit different being a cooperative, quote-unquote, rather than state-owned enterprise? And to follow up on that, your Politburo Standing Committee Roundtable decision-making model, I'm assuming that's something that's really relevant to state sector companies like yours, but not in China's private sector. or is your experience that you think private sector bosses also operate in a consensus-driven model?
Let me take the second one first. If you're so you've got a factory that's 100% private that's making insert rings that are used inside of one of our washing machines. It's a privately owned company, one owner. His wife controls the cash, right? He wants to expand his facility because we've just given him this big new order based on our production for washing machines. And he wants to expand a building that's on property that he owns the rights for. But on four sides of his property are other people. Those people have to approve his expansion program for this particular factory in Qingdao today. So even if you're a privately owned enterprise, you still have to deal with issues like this, where to us it would be normal planning approval, putting it into a process and getting a stamp on it. There is a consensus activity even with a fully privatized company. Hire is in a unique position from its corporate structure. Technically founded as a cooperative called the Qingdao Refrigerator Company. It was technically bankrupt in 1983, and the city government sent a young economist over to either shut it down or renovate it. And that was the beginning. It was a cooperative enterprise. It was owned by all of the employees that were currently employed at that time. That form of corporate governance doesn't exist any longer in China, but that's the form that we still are. So we are a cooperative entity. We're not a state enterprise. We're not privately owned. One could say that we're owned entirely by all the employees that work there, but we don't have any share certificates. It's pretty complicated even in Chinese, let me tell you. When I started talking externally for hire, this is one of those questions, and I sat down and I got the official word, and I read this thing until I was blind, and it is very complicated even in Chinese. But I will say it this way: it doesn't, just like I said this other question about the other party. You know, it's kind of like what Deng Xiaoping said on his first trip to the South. You know, it doesn't matter if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. And it seems to have worked for us so far.
One last quick one. We're just wrapping up on the dot at 2 o'clock here. We've got one last question here.
My name is Tony Dippin with MRI, the Executive Search Company. We have been working with a number of Chinese companies around the point that you were making earlier on, trying to find some foreign managers to come and work with the company. But the China Inc. has a certain employer brand, which is not always popular. You have situations, for example, where senior foreign people have a certain image about what it may be like working for a Chinese company. What message would you have for senior foreign guys that may be seeking employment with emerging Chinese multinational companies to try to dispel that resistance?
Well, I think that's a pretty broad question, isn't it?
Maybe just to clarify, there is a story going around some senior circles that an individual went for an interview and was asked for a flat tire first during the interview. And clearly, you know, that kind of thing, where it does get around, it was more place at that level.
Well, I certainly didn't get asked what my blood type was, but I did have to go through a pre-employment physical, which is pretty much the same you have to do for an international company. One thing that was unique in the experience that I had when I joined Hire was it was something that we're not used to that often in the West, which is group interviews. I went into a room and there was 10 folks there, some who didn't identify themselves, who, you know, proceeded to, we had a 3-hour session, you know, the first time I went there. I think advice that I would give to people that are thinking about working for Chinese companies, there's a couple of things. One is, whether it's around a banquet table or if it's just walking in the hallway, if you can't communicate, you're at a disadvantage. And I want to say personally communicate. If you can't go up to somebody and say, hey, what do you really think about this thing? Or how can we settle this particular issue? Or is that guy good for the company or whatever? If you can't communicate, it's no different than if you're a Chinese person going to work in corporate America in headquarters and not being able to communicate either. No difference. So I think communication is critical. I also think understanding the speed of things is also an issue as well. Some things will move faster than you can imagine, and some things will move at a glacial pace, and you just have to understand that that's the way it's going to be. A lot of Chinese entities are not GAAP/SOX compliant, and so they, which can actually be a good thing. You know, sometimes you don't have to. I mean, we got a lot of pressure in hire for making our numbers, but I don't have pressure for quarterly reportings like I used to have as a corporate officer of other companies. It's not that driven. It's driven on, oh, we've got to see real year-on-year growth. We want market share growth and this and that and so forth. So don't be scared off by the fact that it may or may not be SOX compliant or it may not be GAAP accounting in the numbers that you see. And I guess the last thing I would say is that successful companies, whether they're in China or elsewhere, are successful for a reason. And if you as a person can help them be more successful, or you can help translate some of that success to other parts of the world, you should be okay.
With that, thank you very much. We like to always give our guests something to remember the club by. Get your reporter's notebook too. The rest of you can buy them at the front desk. And we hope we'll see you all here on Wednesday for our next speaker on trade. Thank you very much. Very much for sure. Yeah, my question on the